always having believed it's best to get the bad out of the way before getting to the good. Bad luck, or just bad shit happening to you in life, can make you secretly superstitious, can make you want to take some control, or take back some sense of control. Opal buys scratchers and lottery tickets when the jackpot gets high enough. Her superstition is one she would never call superstition for fear it would lose its power. Opal is done with the odd side of the street. When she crosses, a car stops for her. The woman inside impatiently waves Opal across like she's doing all of humanity a favor. Opal wants to lift her arm, lift a single finger as she crosses, but instead she slow jogs across in answer to the woman's impatience and feigned generosity. Opal hates herself for the jog, for the smile that came to her face before she could stop it, turn it upside down, straighten it out before it was too late. Opal is full of regrets, but not about things she's done. That damn island, her mom, Ronald, and then the shuffling, stifling rooms and faces in foster care, in group homes after that. She regrets that they happened. It doesn't matter that she didn't cause them to happen. She figures she must deserve it in some way, but she couldn't figure it out. So she bore those years, their weight, and the years bored a hole through the middle of her, where she tried to keep believing there was some reason to keep her love intact. Opal is stone solid, but there is troubled water that lives in her, that sometimes threatens to flood, to drown her, rise up to her eyes. Sometimes she can't move. Sometimes it feels impossible to do anything. But that's okay, because she's become quite good at getting lost in the doing of things. More than one thing at a time, preferably, like delivering mail and listening to an audiobook or music. The trick is to stay busy, distract, then distract the distraction, get twice removed. It's about layers. It's about disappearing in the whir of noise and doing. Opal takes out her earphones when she hears a sound up above somewhere, a nasty buzz slicing through the air. She looks up and sees a drone, then looks around to see who might be flying it. When she doesn't see anyone, she puts her earphones back in. She's listening to Otis Redding's Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay. It's her least favorite Otis Redding song because it gets played too much. She shuffles her music and it lands on Smokey Robinson's The Tracks of My Tears. This song gives her that strange mix of sad and happy. Plus, it's upbeat. That's what she loves about Motown, the way it asks you to carry sadness and heartbreak, but dance while doing so. Opal was on her route yesterday when her adopted grandson, Orville, left her a message telling her he'd pulled 3 spider legs out of a bump on his leg. He'd scratched it open, and out came those spider legs like splinters. Opal covered her mouth as she listened to the message, but she wasn't surprised. Not as much as she would have been had this not happened to her when she was around the same age Orville is now. Opal and Jackie's mom never let them kill a spider if they found one in the house, or anywhere for that matter. Her mom said spiders carry miles of web in their bodies, miles of story, miles of potential home and trap. She said that's what we are, home and trap. When the spider legs didn't come up at dinner last night, Opal figured Orville was afraid to bring it up because of the powwow, even though the two things had nothing to do with each other. A few weeks back, she found a video of Orville powwow dancing in his room. Opal regularly checks their phones while they sleep. She looks at what pictures and videos they take, their text messages, and their browser histories. None of them have shown signs of especially worrisome depravity yet, but it's only a matter of time. Opal believes there is a dark curiosity alive in each of us. She believes we all do precisely what we think we can get away with. The way Opal sees it, privacy is for adults. You keep a close eye on your kids. You keep them in line. In the video, Orville was powwow dancing like he knew exactly what he was doing, which she couldn't understand. He was dancing in the regalia she kept in her closet. The regalia was given to her by an old friend. There were all kinds of programs and events for Native youth growing up in Oakland. Opal first met Lucas at a group home, and then again later at a foster youth event. For a time, Opal and Lucas were model foster youth, always the first chosen for interviews and photos for flyers. They'd both learned from an elder what goes into making regalia, then helped her make it. Opal helped Lucas prepare for his first powwow as a dancer. Lucas and Opal had been in love. Their love was young and desperate, but it was love. Then one day, Lucas got on a bus and moved down to Los Angeles. He'd never even talked about it. He just left. Came back almost 2 decades later out of nowhere, wanting an interview for an urban Indian documentary he was making, and gave her the regalia. Then he died a few weeks later. Called Opal from his sister's house to tell her his days were numbered. That's how he put it. He didn't even tell her why. He just said sorry, and that he wished her the very best. But last night, dinner was quiet. Dinner was never quiet. The boys left the table in the same suspicious silence. Opal called Lonnie back. She would ask him how their day went. Lonnie couldn't lie. She'd ask him how he liked his new bike. Plus, it was his turn to do the dishes. But Orville and Luther did something they'd never done before. They helped their little brother dry and put away the dishes. Opal didn't want to force the issue. She really didn't know what to say about it. It was like something was stuck in her throat. It wouldn't come back up and it wouldn't go down. Actually, it was like the bump in her leg the spider legs had come out of. The bump had never gone away. Were there more legs in there? Was that the spider's body? Opal had stopped asking questions a long time ago. The bump remained. When she went to tell the boys to go to bed, she heard one of them shush the other two. "What's that?" she said. "Nothing, Grandma," Luther said. "Don't nothing Grandma me," she said. "It's nothing," Orville said. "Go to sleep," she said. The boys are afraid of Opal, like she was always afraid of her mom. Something about how brief and direct she is. Maybe hypercritical, too, like her mom was hypercritical. It's to prepare them for a world made for Native people not to live but to die in. Shrink. Disappear. She needs to push them harder because it will take more for them to succeed than someone who is not Native. It's because she failed to do anything more than disappear herself. She's no nonsense with them because she believes life will do its best to get at you, sneak up from behind and shatter you into tiny, unrecognizable pieces. You have to be ready to pick everything up pragmatically. Keep your head down and make it work. Death alone eludes hard work and hard-headedness. That and memory. But there's no time and no good reason most of the time to look back. Leave them alone, and memories blur into summary. Opal preferred to keep them there as just that. That's why these damn spider legs have her stuck on the problem. They're making her look back. Opal pulled 3 spider legs out of her leg the Sunday afternoon before she and Jackie left the home, the house, the man they'd been left with after their mom left this world. There'd recently been blood from her first moon. Both the menstrual blood and the spider legs had made her feel the same kind of shame. Something was in her that came out, that seemed so creaturely, so grotesque yet magical, that the only readily available emotion she had for both occasions was shame, which led to secrecy in both cases. Secrets lie through omission, just like shame lies through secrecy. She could have told Jackie about either the legs or the bleeding, but Jackie was pregnant, was not bleeding anymore, was growing limbs inside her they'd agreed she would keep, a child she would give up for adoption when the time came. But the legs and the blood all ended up meaning so much more. The man their mom left them with, this Ronald, he'd been taking them to ceremony, telling them it was the only way they would heal from the loss of their mother. All while Jackie was secretly becoming a mother, and Opal was secretly becoming a woman. But Ronald started to walk by their room at night. Then he took to standing in their doorway, a shadow framed by the door and the light behind him. On a ride home from ceremony, she remembered Ronald mentioning something to them about doing a dream ceremony. Opal didn't like the sound of it. She took to keeping a bat she'd found in their bedroom closet when they first moved in, by her side, next to her in bed. Had taken to holding the thing like she'd once held 2 shoes for comfort. But where 2 shoes was all talk and no action, the bat, which had written on its butt end the name Story, was all action. Jackie had always slept hard as night stays until morning comes. One night, Ronald went over to the end of her bed, a mattress on the floor. Opal had the mattress across from her. When she saw Ronald pull at Jackie's ankles, she didn't even have to think. She'd never swung the bat before, but she knew its weight and how to swing it. Ronald was on his knees, about to pull Jackie up to him. Opal got up, as quiet as she could, breathed in slow, then raised the bat up high behind her. She came down as hard as she could on top of Ronald's head. There was a deep, muffled crack, and Ronald landed on top of Jackie, who woke up and saw her sister standing over them with a bat. They packed their duffel bags as fast as they could, then went downstairs. On the way through the living room, there on the TV was that test pattern Indian they'd seen 1,000 times before. But it was like Opal was seeing him for the first time. Opal imagined the Indian turning to her. He was saying, "Go." Then the sound of him saying go went on too long and turned into the test tone coming from the TV. Jackie grabbed Opal's hand and led her out of the house. Opal still had the bat in her hand. After they left Ronald's, they went to a shelter their mom had always taken them to when they needed help or were between houses. They met with a social worker who asked where they'd been, but didn't push when they didn't tell her. Opal carried the weight of Ronald's possible death around with her for a year. She was scared to go back and check. She was afraid that it didn't bother her that he was dead, that she killed him. She didn't want to go and find out if he was still alive. But she didn't really want to have killed him either. It was easier to let him stay maybe dead. Possibly dead. A year later, Jackie was gone from Opal's life. Opal didn't know where. The last time she'd seen her, Jackie was getting arrested, for what reason Opal couldn't tell. Losing Jackie into the system was just another shitty loss among Opal's many, but she'd met an Indian boy her age, and he made sense to Opal. He wasn't weird or dark, or he was, but in the same ways Opal was. Plus, he never talked about where he came from or what happened to him. They shared that omission like soldiers back from war, all the way up until an afternoon Opal and Lucas were hanging out at the Indian Center, waiting for people to show up for a community meal. Lucas was talking about how much he hated McDonald's. "But it tastes so good," Opal said. "It's not real food," Lucas said as he balanced and walked back and forth on the curb outside. "It's real if I can chew it up and see it come out the other side," Opal said. "Gross," Lucas said. "Wouldn't have been gross if you'd have said it. Girls aren't allowed to talk about farts or poop or curse or... I could swallow pennies and poop them out. That doesn't make them food," Lucas said. "Who told you it's not real?" Opal said. "I had half a cheeseburger I forgot was in my backpack for like a month. When I found it, it looked and smelled exactly the same as when I left it. Real food spoils," Lucas said. "Beef jerky doesn't spoil," Opal said. "Okay, Ronald," Lucas said. "What did you say?" Opal said, and she felt a hot sadness rise up to her eyes from her neck. "I called you Ronald," Lucas said, and stopped walking back and forth on the curb's edge, as in Ronald McDonald. He put his hand on Opal's shoulder and lowered his head a little to try to catch her eyes. Opal pulled her shoulder away. Her face went white. "What?" "I'm sorry. Geez, I'm joking. If you want to know what's funny, I ate that cheeseburger, okay?" Lucas said. Opal walked back inside and sat down on a folding chair. Lucas followed her in and pulled up a chair next to her. After some coaxing, Opal told Lucas everything. He was the first person she'd ever told. Not just about Ronald, but about her mom, the island, what their lives were like before that. Lucas convinced her it would eat her up eventually if she didn't find out for sure about Ronald. "He's like that cheeseburger in my backpack before I ate it," Lucas said. Opal laughed like she hadn't laughed in a long time. A week later, they were on a bus to Ronald's house. They waited for 2 hours across the street from Ronald's house, hiding behind a mailbox. That mailbox became the only thing between finding out and not, between seeing him and not, between her and the rest of her life. She didn't want to live. She wanted time to stop there, to keep Lucas there with her too. Opal went cold when she saw Ronald come home in his truck. Seeing Ronald walk up the stairs to that house, Opal didn't know if she wanted to cry from relief, immediately run away, or go after him, wrestle him to the ground, and finish him off with her bare hands once and for all. Of all that could have occurred to her, what came up in her mind was a word she heard her mom use, a Cheyenne word, veho. It means spider and trickster and white man. Opal always wondered if Ronald was white. He did all kinds of Indian things, but he looked as white as any white man she'd ever seen. When she saw his front door close behind him, it closed the door on all that had come before, and Opal was ready to leave. "Let's go," she said. "You don't want to..." "There's nothing else," she said. "Let's go." They walked the few miles back without saying a word to each other. Opal kept a couple of paces ahead the whole way. Opal is large. If you want to say bone structure-wise, that's fine, but she's big, in a bigger sense than big-bodied or bone structure-wise. She would have to be called overweight in front of medical professionals. But she got big to avoid shrinking. She'd chosen expansion over contraction. Opal is a stone, She's big and strong, but old now and full of aches. Here she is stepping down from her truck with a package. She leaves the box on the porch and walks back out through the gate of the front yard. There across the street from her is a brown and black tiger-striped pit bull baring its teeth and growling a growl so low she can feel it in her chest. The dog is collarless, and time seems the same way here. Time off its leash, ready to skip so fast she'll be dead and gone before she knows it. A dog like this one has always been a possibility, just like death can show up anywhere, just like Oakland can bare its teeth suddenly and scare the shit out of you. But it's not just poor old Opal anymore. It's what would become of the boys if she were gone. Opal hears a man's voice boom from down the street, some name she can't understand. The dog flinches at the sound of its name coming out of this man's mouth. It cowers and turns around, then scurries off toward the voice. The poor dog was probably just trying to spread the weight of its own abuse. There was no mistaking that flinch. Opal gets into her mail truck, starts it, and heads back to the main office.
Octavio Gomez. By the time I got back to my grandma Josefina's house, I could barely stand. She had to drag me up the stairs. My grandma's old and small, and I was pretty big even then, but Fina's strong. She got that crazy strength you can't see. It felt like she carried me all the way up the stairs to the extra room and put me in bed. I was hot and cold as fuck, with this deep-ass ache like my fucking bones were being squeezed or drained or fucking stepped on. It could just be the flu, my grandma said, like I'd asked her what she thought was wrong with me. Or what, I said. I don't know if your dad ever told you anything about curses. She came over to my bed and felt my head with the back of her hand. He gave me my mouth. Curse words don't count. They can do what they can do, but a real curse is more like a bullet fired from far off. She stood over me, folded a wet towel, and put it on my forehead. There's someone aiming a bullet meant for you, but with that distance, most of the time it doesn't hit, and even if it hits, it usually won't kill you. It all depends on the aim of the shooter. You said your uncle never gave you anything. You never took anything from him, right? No, I said. We won't know for now, she said. She came back up with a bowl and a carton of milk. She poured milk into the bowl, then slid the bowl under my bed, stood up, and walked over to a votive candle on the other side of the room. As she lit the candle, she turned around and looked at me like I shouldn't have been looking, like I should have had my eyes closed. Fina's eyes could bite. They were green like mine, but darker. Alligator green. I looked up at the ceiling. She came back over to me with a glass of water. Drink this, she said. My own father cursed me when I was 18. Some old Indian curse my mom told me wasn't real. That was how she said it. Like she knew enough to know it was Indian, and enough to know it wasn't real, but not enough to do anything other than tell me it was an old Indian curse that wasn't real. Fina laughed a little. I handed the glass to her, but she pushed it back toward me like, finish it. I thought I was in love, Fina said. I was pregnant. We were engaged, but he left. I didn't tell my parents at first. But one night my dad came to ask me if I would name his grandson. He was sure it would be a grandson, if I would name the boy after him. I told him then that I wasn't getting married, that the guy had left and that I wasn't going to have the baby either. My dad came after me with this big spoon he sometimes hit me with. He'd sharpen the handle to threaten me with it when he beat me. But this time he came at me with the sharp end. My mom stopped him. He'd crossed anyone, any line, but not through her. The next morning I found a braid of his hair under my bed. That's where my shoes went, so when I went for them the next morning I found the braid. When I got downstairs my mom told me I had to go. Fina walked over to the window and opened it. It's better if we get some air in here. This room needs to breathe. I can get you more blankets if you get cold. I'm fine, I said. which wasn't true. A breeze came in and it felt like my arms and back were being scraped by it. I pulled the blankets up to my chin. This was in New Mexico? Las Cruces, she said. My mom put me on a bus out here to Oakland where my uncle owned a restaurant. When I got here, I got the abortion. And then I got real sick. Off and on for about a year. Worse than you are now, but the same kind of thing. The kind of sick that knocks you down and doesn't let you up. I wrote my mom to ask for help. She sent me a clump of fur, told me to bury it at the western base of a cactus. Clump of fur? About this big. She made a fist and held it up for me to see. Did that work? Not right away. Eventually I stopped getting sick. So was the curse just that you got sick? That's what I thought. But now, with everything that's happened... She turned and looked to the door. The phone was ringing downstairs. I should get that, she said, and stood up to leave. Get some sleep. I stretched, and a hard shiver ran through me. I pulled the blankets over my head. This was that part of the fever where you get so cold you gotta sweat to break it. Hot and cold, with sweat shiver running through and over me. I thought about the night that broke through the windows and walls of our house and brought me to the bed I was doing my best to get better in. Me and my dad had both moved from the couch to the kitchen table for dinner when the bullets came flying through the house. It was like a wall of hot sound and wind. The whole house shook. It was sudden, but it wasn't unexpected. My older brother, Junior, and my uncle Sixto had stolen some plants from someone's basement. They'd come home with two black garbage bags full, hella stupid. That much weight, like some shit wasn't tied to it. Sometimes I'd crawl through the living room to get to the kitchen or watch TV on my stomach on the floor. That night, whoever got their shit stolen by my stupid-ass brother and uncle, they rolled up on our house and emptied their guns into it, into the life we'd known. The life our mom and dad spent years making from scratch. My dad was the only one to get hit. My mom was in the bathroom and Junior was in his room at the back of the house. My dad put himself in front of me, blocked the bullets with his body. Lying in bed wishing for sleep? I didn't want to, but I couldn't help but think of Six. That's what I used to call him. My Uncle Sixto. He called me Eight. I hadn't really known him growing up, but after my dad died, he started to come around a few days every week. Not that we said much to each other. He'd come over and turn on the TV, smoke a blunt, drink. He let me drink with him. Pass me the blunt. I never liked getting high. Shit just made me feel hella nervous. Made me think too much about the speed of the beat of my heart. Was it too slow? Would it stop, or was it too fast? Would it fucking attack? I liked to drink, though. After the shooting, Junior stayed out even more than usual. Claimed he was gonna fuck those guys up, that it meant war. But Junior was all talk. Sometimes me and Six would be watching TV in the afternoon, and the sun would come in through one of the bullet holes, one of the ones in the wall, and I could see the fucking dust in the room float in a bullet hole-shaped ray of light. My mom had replaced the windows and the doors, but she hadn't bothered to fill the holes in the walls. Hadn't bothered, or didn't want to. After a few months, Sixto stopped coming over, and Fina told me to spend more time with my cousins Manny and Daniel. Their mom had called Fina to ask for help. That made me wonder if my mom had called Fina to ask for help after my dad died. And was that why Six came over? Fina had a hand in everything. She was the only one trying to keep us all together. Keep us all from falling through the holes life opened up out of nowhere like those bullets that ripped through the house that night. Manny and Daniel's dad had lost his job and had been going harder at the drink. At first I went over out of duty. You did what Fina told you to do. But then I got close with Manny and Daniel. Not that we talked. Mostly we played video games together in the basement. But we spent almost all our free time together when we weren't in school. And it turns out that who you spend time with ends up mattering more than what you do with that time. One day we were down in the basement when we heard a noise upstairs. Manny and Daniel looked at each other like they knew what it was, and like they didn't want it to be that. Manny bolted up from the couch. I ran behind him. When we got upstairs, the first thing we saw was their dad throwing their mom against the wall, then slapping her once with each hand. She pushed him, and he laughed. I'll never forget that laugh. And then how Manny took that laugh right the fuck out of him. Manny came up from behind his dad and pulled back on his neck like he was trying to rip all the breath he'd ever taken out of him. Manny was bigger than his dad, and he pulled back hard. They stumbled backward into the living room. I heard Daniel coming up the stairs. I opened the door and put my hand up like, stay down there. Then I heard the sound of glass crashing. Manny and his dad had gone through the glass table in the living room. In their struggle, Manny had managed to turn them around, so he landed on top of his dad on the glass table. Manny was cut a little on his arms, but his dad was all sliced up. He got knocked out, too. I thought he was fucking dead. Help me get him in the car, Manny said to me. And I did. I picked his dad up from under his arms. On our way out the front door, when I was almost out the door, with Manny at the other end holding his dad's legs, I saw Daniel and Aunt Sylvia watching us carry him out of the house. Something about them seeing us, crying because they wanted him gone, crying because they wanted him back the way he used to be. That shit killed me. We dropped their dad off in the front of Highland, where the ambulances come in. Left him on the ground. Honked the horn once real long, and drove off. I was around more after that. We didn't even know if we killed him or not until a week later. The doorbell rang and it was like Manny knew, like he felt it. He tapped my knee twice and sprang up. At the front door we stood there and didn't have to say a thing. We stood there like, what? What the fuck do you want? Go! His face was all bandaged. He looked like a fucking mummy. I felt bad for him. Sylvia came up behind us with a trash bag full of his clothes, yelling, move! So we moved out of the way, and she threw the bag at him. Manny closed the door, and that was that. It was around that time that me and Manny stole our first ride. We took BART to downtown Oakland. There were certain pockets of uptown where people had nice cars, and people like me and Manny could be seen without someone calling the cops right away. Manny wanted a Lexus. Just nice enough, but not too nice. Not noticeable either. We found a black one with gold lettering and tinted windows. I don't know how long Manny had been stealing cars, but he got in quick with a coat hanger, then with a screwdriver in the ignition. The inside smelled like cigarettes and leather. We rode down East 14th, which had been International, but shit got so bad all up and down International that they changed the name to something without the history. I rummaged through the glove box and found some Newports. We both thought it was weird for someone we assumed was white to be smoking Newports. Neither one of us smoked cigarettes, but we smoked those, blasted the radio, and didn't say a single word to each other the whole ride. There was something about that ride, though. It was like we could put on someone else's clothes, live in someone else's house, drive their car, smoke their smokes, even if just for an hour or two. Once we made it deep enough east, we knew we'd be fine. We parked it at the Coliseum BART station parking lot and walked back to Manny's house, high on having gotten away with it so easily. The system scared you, so you thought you had to follow the rules, but we were learning that that shit was fucking flimsy. You could do what you could get away with. That's where it was at. I was at Manny's house when Sylvia called down into the basement to tell me Fina was on the phone. She never called me there. Daniel took the controller from me before I went up. He killed them, Fina said. I couldn't even understand what she meant. Your Uncle Sixto, she said. He crashed his car with both of them in it. They're dead. I ran out the front door, got on my bike and hurried the fuck home. My heart was some crazy mix of fuck no, fuck this, and like it had slipped out of me. Before I got to Fina's, I thought, well then Six better be fucking dead too. Fina was standing in her doorway. I jumped off my bike in one motion and ran inside the house like I was gonna find someone else there. My mom and brother. Sixto. I had to believe it was a joke or any fucking thing other than what Fina's face was telling me in that doorway that it was. Where is he? They took him to jail. Downtown. What the fuck? My knees gave out on me. I was on the ground, not crying, but like I couldn't move, and I got real fucking sad for a minute, And then that shit did a 180 and I yelled some shit I don't remember. Fina didn't do or say anything when I got back on my bike and left. I can't remember what I did or I went that night. Sometimes you just go, and you're gone. After the funerals, I moved in with Fina. She told me Sixto was out. They gave him a DUI. He lost his license, but they let him go. Fina told me not to go see him. Never to go see him. To let it be. I didn't know what I would do if I went over there, but there wasn't shit she could do to stop me. On the way over to his house, I stopped in the parking lot of a liquor store I knew wouldn't check my ID. I went in and bought a fifth of E&J. That was what Six drank. I didn't know what I meant to do going over there. In my mind, I had it like I would get him drunk and fucking beat the shit out of him. Maybe kill him. But I knew it wouldn't be like that. Six had his ways about him. Not that I wasn't mad enough to do it. I just didn't know what it would be like. On my way out of the store, I heard a mourning dove somewhere nearby. The sound gave me goosebumps. Not the cold kind, and not the good kind either. We had mourning doves in our backyard for as long as I can remember, under the back porch. My dad once said to me, when we were in the backyard trying to fix my bike, he said, "Their sound is so sad, you almost want to kill them for it." Once my dad was gone, I felt like I heard them more, or it was just that they reminded me of him and his attitude toward most kinds of sadness. I didn't want to feel sad then either, and it was like those fucking birds were making me feel it. So I went into the backyard with the BB gun I got for Christmas when I was 10. One of them was facing the wall, like he'd really been singing toward me inside. I shot it in the back of the head and then in the back twice. The bird flew up right away, its feathers rising, then falling slow while it flapped in a flash of crooked downward spirals. It landed in the next door neighbor's yard. I waited to hear if it would move. I thought about how it would have felt. The sting in the head and the back after it flew up over me. I didn't feel even a little bit sorry for the bird because of how sad it made me feel ever since my dad got shot, when I had to look down and see my dad's eyes blink in disbelief. My dad looking back up at me like he was the one who was sorry. Sorry that I had to see him go like that, with no control over the wild possibilities reality threw into our lives. At Sixto's house, I knocked on his door. "Hey, Six, hey," I said. I backed away from the house, looked at the upstairs window. I heard footsteps, loud and slow. When Six opened the door, he didn't even look at me or wait for me to say or do anything. He just walked back into the house. I followed him to his bedroom, found a place to sit on an old office chair he kept in the corner. I was surprised to find it empty considering the state of the rest of the room. Clothes, bottles, trash, and a light sprinkling of tobacco, weed and ash all over everything. He was hella fucking sad seeming. And I hated that I wanted to say something to make him feel better. That was the first time I saw it different. Like felt for him and how he must have felt about what he did. "I got us a bottle," I said. "Let's go in the back." I heard him get up and follow me as I walked out of the room. Six had a few chairs back there in that overgrown, crooked fenced yard between two fruitless orange and lemon trees that I remembered used to be full. We drank for a while in silence. I watched him smoke a blunt. I kept expecting him to start the conversation, say something about what happened to my mom and brother, but he didn't. Six lit up a cigarette. "When we were kids," Sixto said, "me and your dad, we used to sneak into your grandma's closet. She had an altar set up in there. All sorts of crazy shit on that altar. Like she had a skull. It was the skull of what they call little people. She told us the little people stole babies and kids. She had jars full of powders and different kinds of herbs and stones. One time she caught me and your dad in there. She told your dad to go home. He ran like hell. She can get pretty crazy in her eyes. They go all dark like she keeps a darker pair behind the green ones you usually see. I had that little skull in my hand. She told me to put it down. She told me I had something in me I wasn't gonna be able to get out this time around. She told me I could handle it like a man. Die with it. But that I could also share it with family. I could give it away over time. Even to strangers. It was some old dark leftover thing that stayed with our family. Some people get diseases passed down in their genes. Some people get red hair, green eyes. We got this old thing that hurts real fucking bad. Makes you mean. That's what you got. That's what your grandpa had in him. Be a man, she told me. Keep it to yourself. Sixto picked up the bottle, took a deep pull from it. I looked at Six, looked at his eyes to see if he expected me to say anything. Then he dropped the bottle on the grass and stood up. I couldn't believe he hadn't brought up my mom and brother. Or was that what he was trying to get at? Was this some long explanation for why all the shit happened to our family happened the way it did? Let's go, he said to me like we'd just been talking about going somewhere. He brought me to his basement. He pulled out a wooden box that looked like a toolbox. Said it was his medicine box. You're gonna have to help me out here, he said, his words dragging a little behind. He pulled out a dried plant with red rope tied around it. He lit it. The smell and smoke were thick. It smelled like musk and earth and fina. I didn't know anything about ceremony, whatever he was doing, but I knew we shouldn't have been drunk for it. This comes from a long way back, Six said, and poured some powder into his hand. Then he gestured for me to move my head closer, as if to see it better. Then he took a big breath in and blew it all in my face. It was thick as sand and some got in my mouth. Up my nose. I choked and kept blowing out my nose like a dog. We got bad blood in us, Sixto said. Some of these wounds get passed down. Same with what we owe. We should be brown. All that white you see that you got on your skin? We gotta pay for what we done to our own people. Sixto's eyes were closed, his head bent down a little. Fuck this shit, Six, I said through a cough, then stood up. Sit down, Six said, with a tone he'd never used with me before. It's not all bad. It's power, too. I sat down, but then stood right back up. I'm fucking going. I said sit down. Six blew on that plant again. The smoke rose thick. I felt sick right away. Weak. I made it out to the front of the house, got on my bike, and rode to Fina's. When I woke up the next day, Fina came in and shook her car keys at me. Get up. Let's go, she said. I was still pretty tired, but the fever had broken. I thought we were maybe going to get groceries. When we got past Castro Valley, I knew it wasn't groceries or any kind of errand. We just kept driving, through the hills with all those windmills. I fell asleep looking at one of them that looked like a coin from Mario Brothers. When I woke up, we were in a field with orchards on either side of it. Fina was on top of the hood of the car. She was looking down at something. I opened my door, and when I did, I saw Fina's hand wave me back. So I sat down without closing the door. Through the windshield, I saw my grandma get onto her knees and yank something with a thread or fishing line. Something I couldn't see until the creature came scrambling up on the windshield. Get his fur! Get some of his fur! Fina yelled at me, but I couldn't move. I just stared at it. The fuck was it? A raccoon? No. And then Fina was on top of the thing. It was black with a white stripe that went from its nose to the back of its neck. The thing was trying to bite and claw her, but she had her hand on its back, and it couldn't grip the metal hood. When it seemed to calm down, she lifted it up by its neck with the fishing line. Come get some of its fur, she said. How? I said. Rip its fucking fur off with your hands, Fina said. That was enough to get me going. I got out of the car and tried to get behind the thing, but it was on to me. I swiped twice, but didn't want to get bit. Then on the third try, I pulled a big clump from its side. Now get back in the car, Fina said, and got to her feet. She let the thing down to the ground. She walked with it farther into the field and then into the orchard at the edge of the field. When she got back into the car, I was just sitting there with my hand up in a fist, holding the clump of fur. Fina pulled out a leather bag with beadwork and fringes on it, opened it, and gestured for me to put the fur inside. "What was that?" I said once we were on the road.
"Badger."
"Why?" "We're gonna set up a box for you."
"What?"
"We're gonna make you a medicine box." "Oh," I said, like that was all the explanation I needed. We drove for a while in silence, then Fina looked over at me. "Long time ago, they didn't have a name for the sun." She pointed up to the sun, which was in front of us. "They couldn't decide if it was a man or a woman or what. All the animals met about it, and a badger came out of a hole in the ground and called out the name. But as soon as he did, he ran. The other animals came after him. That badger went underground and stayed there. He was afraid they would punish him for naming it." Fina flipped on her blinker and switched lanes to pass a slow truck in the right lane. "Some of us got this feeling stuck inside all the time, like we've done something wrong. Like we ourselves are something wrong. Like who we are deep inside. That thing we want to name but can't. It's like we're afraid we'll be punished for it. So we hide. We drink alcohol because it helps us feel like we can be ourselves and not be afraid. But we punish ourselves with it. The thing we most don't want has a way of landing right on top of us. That badger medicine's the only thing that stands a chance at helping. You gotta learn how to stay down there. Way deep down inside yourself. Unafraid." I turned my head. Looked down at the gray streak of road. It hit me somewhere in the middle of my chest. All that she'd said was true. It hit me in the middle, where it all comes together like a knot. "Six have a box?" I said, even though I knew. "You know he does. Do you help him make it?" "That boy never let me help him make anything," she said, her voice breaking. She wiped her eyes. "He thinks he can make it all up himself, but look where that got him. I've been meaning to tell you. I went over there to see him." "How did he seem?" Fina asked real quick, like she'd been waiting for me to bring it up. "He was all right. But we drank. And then he brought me to the basement. Started talking about giving me some shit. Lighting this plant in a shell, and then he blew some powder stuff in my face." "How do you feel?" "Like I want to fucking kill him. For real." "Why? What do you mean, why?" "He didn't do any of it on purpose," Fina said. "He's lost. He fucked up." "So did your brother. Six was part of that, too." "So? We all fuck up. It's how we come back from it that matters." "I don't know what the fuck I'm supposed to do, then. I can't get him back. I can't get them back. I don't know what the fuck any of this is about." "You're not supposed to," she said, and rolled down her window. It was getting hot. I rolled mine down, too. "That's the way this whole thing is set up," she said. "You're not ever supposed to know. Not all the way. That's what makes the whole thing work the way it does. We can't know. That's what makes us keep going." I wanted to say something but couldn't. I didn't know what to say. It seemed both right and like the wrongest shit possible. I stayed quiet. The rest of the car ride and then for weeks after that. And she let me.
Daniel Gonzalez. The guys lost their shit when I showed them the gun. Pushed each other and laughed like they hadn't done since forever ago. Everything got so fucking serious after Manny died. Which it should have. I'm not saying it shouldn't have. But he would have loved to see them like that. He would have loved the gun, too. It was a real gun. As real as any gun, but it was white and plastic, and I printed it from a 3D printer in my room, which is in the basement, which used to be Manny's room. I still can't think of him as gone. For now, Manny's not here or there. He's in the middle of the middle, where you can only be when you can't be anywhere. The gun only took 3 hours to print. My mom made tacos for the guys while they watched the Raiders game. I stayed downstairs and watched the gun spool out in layers.
When they came down, we watched the last of it get printed in silence. I knew they wouldn't know what to think. That's why I had a YouTube video pulled up to show them. A 30-second time-lapse of a guy 3D printing, then firing a gun. Once they saw that, that's when they all lost their shit. They yelled and pushed at each other like they were kids again. Like it used to be over simpler shit like video games. Like when we used to have all-night Madden tournaments, and someone would win at 4 in the morning, and we'd be all loud, and my dad would come down with that little metal bat he kept by his bed. It was the bat he taught us to hit with when we were younger. An aluminum bat. And he'd hit us with that shit too. That same bat we got for free at that A's game, where they were giving them away and we showed up early to be sure to get one. Manny wouldn't like that Octavio came over so much after he died. I mean, in a big way it was Octavio's fault. But he's our cousin. And him and Manny had become like brothers. All three of us had. It's true, Octavio shouldn't have run his mouth at that party. For a while I hated him for it, blamed him too. But he kept coming back around, making sure we were okay, me and my mom. And the more I got to thinking about it, it wasn't all on him. Manny's the one who fucked that kid up. It was on all of us, really. We turned our heads, looked the other way when Manny fucked that kid up so bad on the front lawn. The blood stained brown on the yellow grass there until I got the mower out and cut it. And then when it was good, when money came in before Manny died, we didn't ask where it was coming from. We took the TV and the random cash he left on the kitchen table in envelopes. We allowed the shit in and only wanted it out when it took him from us. I knew they believed in the white gun for real when I picked it up and pointed it at them. They flinched, put their hands up. Not Octavio, though. He told me to put it down. There were no bullets in the gun, but I hadn't felt in control for so long. I know guns are stupid, but that doesn't mean they don't make you feel in control when you're holding one. Octavio pulled the gun out of my hands. He looked down the barrel, pointed it at us. That's when it was my turn to get scared. Octavio holding it made it even more real, made the white of it creepy. Like some plastic message from the future about shit getting into the wrong hands. After the guys left that night, I decided to write my brother an email. I'd helped him set it up. A Gmail account. Manny barely used it, but sometimes he wrote me. And when he did, he said shit he never would have said in real life. That's what was cool about it. I opened up my Gmail and replied to the last email my brother sent. No matter what happens, you know I'll always be here for you. He was talking about fights he was getting in with our mom. She kept threatening to kick him out after he beat that kid up. The cops had come. Way too late, but they'd come. Asked questions. She could sense shit was getting more serious. A tension was building in him. I could feel it too, but didn't know what to say. It was like he'd been moving toward that bullet.